From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. In the first part of the show, we'll talk about cicadas. This year, a cicada brood on a 17-year cycle is now emerging at the same time as a brood on a 13-year cycle. This is the first time this has happened since 1803, Chris.
That's right. What impacts might this have on our environment? Pros and cons. We'll speak with ecologist Hannah Burak, Chief Academic and Administrative Officer of the Department of Entomology at Michigan State University, about cicadas, this unique convergence of broods, and just how long these cycles will last, all that in the first part of the show.
Then, in the second part of the show, we'll turn our attention to the Mississippi River. Over thousands of years, the Mississippi watershed was home to millions of indigenous people who regarded the Great River with awe and respect, adorning its banks with astonishing spiritual earthworks.
But European settlers and American pioneers had a different vision. The river was a foe to conquer. Naturalist and author Boyce Upholt tells the epic story of human attempts to own and contain the Mississippi River in his new book, The Great River, The Making and Unmaking of the Mississippi. He reveals how an ambitious and sometimes contentious program of engineering, government-built levees, jetties, dikes, and dams, has not only damaged once vibrant ecosystems, but may not work much longer. And he explores how scientists are scrambling to restore what's been lost. Boyce Upholt on his new book, The Great River, in the second part of the show. All that and some news about PFASs in drinking water, what the EPA is asking water providers to do, and the pushback they are receiving from the chemical industry. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hailing from my home state is Hannah Burak, who works with Michigan State University. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
So, Hannah, you are here to talk to us about the cicadas and this converged emergence that is happening. So, Hannah, first of all, let's talk about your job and what you do with Michigan State University, and then we'll get into what a cicada is and why this is such a unique occurrence happening.
Sure. So I am a professor and chairperson in the Department of Entomology here at Michigan State University. And what that means is that I have the privilege of working with our outstanding faculty, staff, and students to do research on how insects impact our daily lives and what we can learn about them to better improve our world and our society. So that's really, in a nutshell, what I focus on.
Great. And one of the things that has been a hot topic as of late is the cicadas and this dual emergence. Let's define first the insect species itself. So what is a cicada?
All right. So cicadas are roughly 1 to 2 inch long insects that are, they have a diversity of different life cycles. The ones that we're talking about, their bodies are a dark black, and they have bright red eyes and orange wings that have like very distinct veins netting on them. They're kind of bullet shaped. And as both adults and immature stages, they feed on plants. So they have long straw-like mouth parts that they use to pierce plant cells and feed on the liquid again there. And one of the reasons that people are talking about cicadas so much this year is because they have a small number of species, so 7 of about 3,000 species that are known worldwide that occur here in North America, west of the Rocky Mountains. So I'm sorry you guys don't get to experience fun periodic cicadas out where you are. 7 of these species are what we call periodic cicadas, which mean that they synchronize their immature development so that they all emerge en masse at either 13 or 17 year intervals. And we call the populations that emerge in one group at a time a brood. And so we have 13 year broods, we have 17 year broods. And in most years, there's one of these broods emerging somewhere in the eastern US. But this year, 2 of these broods, one 13-year and one 17-year brood, are emerging simultaneously. And what that means is that from basically Illinois, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, much of the eastern U.S. has the potential to experience a mass cicada emergence. So we have one population called the Northern Illinois Brood and one population called the Great Southern Brood. And the geographic area that those two populations cover covers most of the middle of the country in the eastern U.S.
So why is it that they stay underground for so long? What's happening down there, and what's the pace of the different broods?
So we think this is an ecological adaptation that they use to avoid predation and hopefully maximize their likelihood of in survival as an individual. And so things that eat cicadas are small mammals, reptiles, other insects, maybe your pets if you happen to be out in your yard. And so by emerging in these huge numbers, and when we say huge numbers, we're talking about hundreds of thousands in a geographic area, you know, in an acre to several acres. Some massive numbers of these insects, they overwhelm those natural predators, and more of them are likely to survive and reproduce until the next year. And then once they mate, the females lay eggs in branches, stems, branches of perennial plants. And those eggs hatch after a couple weeks, drop down into, well, the eggs hatch quickly, they drop down into the ground, they tunnel underneath the soil, and they develop as nymphs underground for either that 13 or 17-year period, depending on the population or the brood that we're talking about. What they're doing under the ground is sticking their straw-like mouthparts into roots of those same woody perennials that they're parents laid their eggs on and slowly feeding the parts of the plant tissue that they feed on. So they feed on xylem, which is a pretty nutrient-poor liquid in plants. And so it takes them a while to slowly grow to maturity. And then 13 or 17 years later, they come out for about a month and a half long party, and it starts all over again.
What type of plants do they prefer?
So they need to be on woody perennials, something that is going to be in the ground for 13 or 17 years, because they're not going to be tunneling and moving underground to find other places to survive. And so those are going to be trees in established wooded areas, perennial plants, shrubs, are things that are able to live for that duration.
Is that one reason why we don't have them here out west?
So I think one of the reasons we don't have the periodic cicada populations out west is that the Rocky Mountains are a fantastic natural barrier to dispersion. And so this unique life history pattern developed in the eastern U.S. and perhaps wasn't as advantageous in the western U.S. or never occurred. And that Rocky Mountain barrier has kept those populations separated, and there hasn't been any overlap. You do have many of the non-periodic cicadas in the western U.S. So if you go out in both in the Rocky Mountains and west, there are lots of cicada species. They're just not going to be the ones that are cycled up on a 13 or 17-year interval.
Okay.
And we all know what they sound like, and that sound when hundreds of thousands of them are together. I lived in Singapore for a little bit, and we had cicadas there, and it was really, really loud in the morning. You could hear these cicadas. So, what is that noise level going to be like when they all emerge?
It can be very loud. I encourage folks who are interested in hearing what that sounds like to just do a quick Google search. You can find some videos of our friends, particularly in the southern U.S. and the upper Midwest, who've been recording what the wooded areas near their homes sound like over the last month or so. It can be very loud. I think one thing to keep in mind is cicadas are daytime active insects, and so they're not going to keep you up all night. If you hear bugs at nighttime, that's probably going to be katydids or something else that's related to cicadas, but not our periodic cicada friends. So you will be able to sleep if you have kind of a normal daytime, nighttime schedule. But yes, they can be very loud. I will say one other thing. I had been contacted by a disability access individual, and they were wondering about folks who have sound sensitivity who might be living near areas where these broods were going to be emerging, and if there were things that they could do to minimize their exposure to large volumes of sounds. And I tried to reassure them that, you know, the sounds are going to be loudest in natural areas. So areas that are wooded, forests, public parks that have good wooded tree populations. They're not going to be as common or intense in urban areas just because we don't maintain the plants that are going to support them for the duration of their life cycle in many urban areas. And so for people who might have sound sensitivity or are concerned about noise, maybe not going hiking for the, you know, month of June might be something that they want to think about. And then later in the summer, when our periodic cicadas have all had their wild party, have been passed on and are now starting to fertilize those same trees that they laid their eggs on, that might be a good time to go out and commune with nature again.
Once they emerge, how do they fit into this ecosystem above ground? And what kind of differences can they make to that end? And are they harmful at all to any trees or plants?
Yeah, so I'll tackle the harmful to any trees or plants question first. This is a question we get a lot. And really the time when they're most likely to impact a tree or a plant is when the females are laying those eggs. And so the individual cicadas feeding on either roots when they're immatures in the soil or above ground plant parts when they're adults is probably pretty minimal. However, the females, when they lay their eggs, they strongly prefer kind of pencil diameter branches or stems. And so if you have planted brand new shrubs or trees that have a whole lot of their plant tissue at that pencil diameter, those are shrubs and trees that might be negatively impacted by cicada infestations. And so we advise folks who are in that situation to cover those with fine mesh or row cover fabric for that 1 month duration when the adults are out. And that's very effective at preventing the females from being able to lay eggs. I used to live and work as an entomologist in North Carolina, and they're experiencing the Great Southern Brood Emergence right now. And one of the things that they've noted is some of their commercial blueberry farms that are in areas where the mass emergence is occurring are experiencing egg laying on their blueberry bushes. And so anybody who's familiar with a blueberry plant knows that there's a whole lot of the pencil diameter type stems and branches there. That's not going to kill the plant. It will probably cause that branch or that stem to die down and fall off. And so particularly small scale blueberry producers, so people who are doing like pick your own or direct market type blueberry production, have been concerned about seeing this egg laying occurring. For a large commercial producer, this is going to be like not a significant economic impact or reduction in yield. But for, you know, somebody who has a relatively small amount of bushes, who really wants every single berry to make it to harvest, that can be a challenge for them to handle. And in those situations, it's not really practical to cover the bushes with fabric. So they are going to experience some loss of fruit this year. But that's a really specific situation that's pretty uncommon for most people. In your average yard, you're typically not going to have any real visible impact of cicadas. So that's the negative end of things. Let's talk about the cool ecology stuff for just a sec. My favorite story with cicadas is that not only are they this huge resource pulse for all the animals that feed on the adults above ground, so our birds, our small mammals, our reptiles, we can actually see benefits in bird populations for multiple years after a cicada emergence. Their offspring are healthier, more likely to survive, and more likely to then reproduce following years. Oh, wow. So there's this cascading benefit for some of their predators. But the other cool story is that we can track changes in the microbe community in the soil where cicadas die and decompose. It's a massive resource pulse for both that beneficial microbial community that keeps our soil healthy, but also for the trees and plants that the immature cicadas are going to develop on. So it actually fertilizes the very plants that the babies are going to develop on over the next 13 to 17 years.
I don't know if you heard that, but Chris had to look it up.
I'm playing some cicadas in the background, so we have some background music.
That wasn't quite it. That it's a little bit, feel like it's a little bit sweeter than that. That just sounds like a mic gone bad. But
really?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe it's the different parts of the country.
So, yeah. So Hannah, that's interesting that you're saying that the birds can benefit from this emergence. Are we seeing, though, again, like influx of maybe small animals in those areas that do feed off of them? So how is that affecting that area?
Yeah, so I haven't seen studies that look at like changes in small mammal populations. I'm sure someone has done this at some point, so I can't really cite that specifically, but I can tell you lots of people will share with me that they're particularly their dogs are big fans of eating cicadas when they're out on walks. And so sometimes they have to manage that to make sure that they don't overindulge in this massive resource that they have exposure to.
We're speaking with Hannah Burak. She's the Chief Academic and Administrative Officer with the Department of Entomology at Michigan State University. We're talking about cicadas and, you know, this year the convergence of two brood cycles. But Hannah, I want to make sure I understand. There are broods that come out every year, correct?
Most years there will be a brood somewhere.
Okay.
And so the unique thing about this year is these two broods, the Northern Illinois brood and Great Southern brood, that cover a huge geographic area in the eastern U.S. are both emerging. And so a big swath of the country and lots of people are experiencing a cicada emergence, where in most years it's a much smaller geographic area and it's much more kind of locally exciting or concerning, but not something that the whole, you know, eastern half of the country is thinking about.
Right. And so we mentioned in the introduction that this is the first time since 1803, so well over 200 years since this convergence has occurred. Does it mean that it's going to be another 200 years before we see this type of convergence?
Yep. So in 221 years, this will happen again. So probably none of us will be around to see that. But our great-grandchildren maybe will be thinking about visiting the offspring of this past progeny from this group of cicadas.
Are they treated as, can they be treated as pests in some, you know, towns and municipalities? I'm thinking about, do towns and municipalities go so far as to spray for them?
So it would be pretty ineffective
okay.
to try to spray for them. There's just so many of them. They're in places where there's a lot of other insect life that
right.
we probably want to maintain. And so we wouldn't want to have the negative impacts on those other species. And they're going to continue to keep coming out. And so anything that we might use is not going to have any long-term activity. And so it would be pretty ineffective and potentially disruptive to other insects to think about spraying for them. So it's one of those things we kind of have to embrace and find the things that are exciting about it to us and not try to have a whole lot of control on it because it's not going to be something we can really manage.
And right. it's so
right.
temporary.
Right.
So what is the time frame that this is going to occur?
So the adults will be out for about a month and a half, and that they can emerge kind of throughout that entire month and a half period. You'll have some early guys, most of the people in the middle, and some stragglers at the end, and then they live for 4 to 6 weeks once they come out. So it's a pretty short pulse of time and activity in the grand scheme of things.
Okay. Are there other insects that act in this same way, that have broods year over year and have different cycles and things, or is this just unique to cicadas?
So this particular periodicity is it's very much a cicada thing.
Huh.
We don't have other ones that have this very concentrated mass emergence over a predictable period of time. We do have lots of insects that can be extremely long-lived. And so, you know, when you first hear that there's insects that live for 13 years or 17 years, I think that can be surprising to a lot of folks who don't study bugs.
Mm-hmm.
But there are lots of other long-lived insects who live for, you know, 5 to even up to 50 years, but none of them have this same concentrated synchronized emergence. Certainly over a big geographic area.
Right.
Yeah. Wasn't there something with locusts though that happened where there was a grand emergence as well? I think I remember.
Yeah. So there are plague locusts. And they're a little bit different in that what triggers whether or not you have a mass emergence and then dispersion of the quote unquote plague locusts. And those are mostly in kind of what we say the old world, so Europe, Africa. And there was a North American locust that had mass emergent cycles, but it's been extirpated from the US due to development over time. And so what triggers them is actually the buildup of their populations as more solitary individuals. It's super cool when they get too crowded. The physical contact with other locusts triggers them to later, for later generations, to turn into larger, heavier, more capable of long distance flight insects. And then those are the populations that disperse wildly and feed on everything in their path. And so it's less predictable than a 13 or 17 year, you can basically set your clock by its cycle. And it's more driven by the growth of the solitary populations of those insects. And so that could happen just depending on how quickly or slowly those populations reproduce.
So are people in your field going to be traveling about? And do you think that you will be heading out to a certain area to study or take this in?
Yeah, so a number of my colleagues have already been making trips. Nearest to us, the best chance of seeing large populations is in Illinois. So I have had friends and colleagues who have made their way to state parks and national forests in Illinois to check out the cicada emergence. I also have a colleague, Joseph Yoon, who runs a company called Brooklyn Bugs, which is dedicated to insect eating. And he spent several weeks in Illinois communing and then cooking with cicadas as a possible wild foraged food source. So there's also folks doing that as well. This is a big deal for entomologists. This is something that we don't see a whole lot. And we always, you know, there's a lot of people who are really excited about
it. You just sparked my curiosity. We only have a minute or so, but the act of either us trying to consume these insects in some form, or maybe as a feed for animals or so, is that being explored?
Yeah, so there are already companies that produce insects, not cicadas, but other more easy to rear insects for animal food. That's a really growing and exciting area of entomological science. And there are others who are interested in this wild foraging component. And so, yes, there are lots of people who are interested in thinking about ways we can diversify our protein sources by using insects. And cicadas are attractive because there are just so darn many of them when we have these periodic emergences.
That's right. Take an issue and turn it into, you know, a win for us in some form, like we do with crickets, because we've had cricket-based flour.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's
I've actually eaten actual crickets and breads. I did a story on insect eating as well. And
protein
so
bars.
It is a good source of protein, apparently. And it does taste a little like chicken.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Why not?
Just kidding. So Hannah, where can people go or where can we direct them to get more information about what your studies are or this cicada emergence?
Absolutely. So if you're listening in an area where you have cicada populations, mass emergences present, your local extension service is a great place to start. I always like to see people working with their local experts because they know boots on the ground what the best information is. But they're also welcome to check out our Michigan State University entomology website. And I'll give a little plug to my colleagues at Ohio State University. They have some great cicada recipes up on their extension website.
That's generous of you. As a Michigander, wow.
No,
Hannah,
right?
Going across aisles, good for you. Well, we are really thrilled to have had you on our show today, and thank you so much for all the information that you gave to us. And we do have a lot of Midwesterners here in the Park City and Summit County and Wasatch areas, so I'm sure if they're heading back home, maybe they can check out some of this cicada serenade that's happening out there right now. Thank you so much, Hannah, for being on the
show. Thanks, Hannah.
Thank you.
All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll turn our attention to the Mississippi River and speak with Boyce Upholt, the author of the new book, The Great River, the making and the unmaking of the Mississippi. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back. Joining us for the second part of the show is Boyce Upholt. He is a writer, naturalist, nature critic, and the author of the new book, which I believe, if I had this right, is coming out today, is being released today, titled The Great River, The Making and Unmaking of the Mississippi. Boyce, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, and thanks for taking the time to talk about your book coming out today. You were born, raised in Connecticut, schooled back east, like most of us. We live out here. But you started writing about the Mississippi, if I did my research right, somewhere around 2015, articles, et cetera. Where does the name Mississippi come from?
It's an interesting, I think, important story. I mean, that word Mississippi is Ojibwe or Anishinaabe. And the reason why that is what we call this river, in particular, kind of one of the reasons why we think of the Mississippi as running north to south down the center of the continent, is because the first people to kind of give one name to all of this river were some French explorers, their priests and fur traders that were kind of traveling down from Ojibwe country up sort of in those northern territories and coming downstream. And so, interestingly, I lived for years in Mississippi, the state of Mississippi, where I started writing about the river. And, you know, that state is named with a language that was not spoken in that part of the country.
Yeah, and so for, like we said, alluded to in the intro, for thousands of years, indigenous nations lived along the Mississippi and, of course, took advantage of the resources that it provided. And so how was the Mississippi treated by, let's say, pre-colonial whites, European settlers?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways I answer that most by saying an answer in absence of what they did not do, which is like we don't have any record of levees being built along the river, which are the sort of startlingly present form of engineering today. And mm-hmm. so there are lots of what I call earthworks, what are more often called mounds, all along the Mississippi and its tributaries. This form of seemingly spiritual architecture that in my research I came to think really seemed to have begun on the lower Mississippi River in Louisiana, and potentially symbolizes sort of how important this very swampy, very wild-feeling ecosystem and landscape was to people all up and down the watershed. People seem to look to the river as, despite its constant chaos and flooding, as a really life-giving force that managed to, you know, because of these floods, sort of brought soils, brought waters that led to abundant food and wildlife all along up and down the river.
So the earthworks were more of a kind of a ritual or spiritual component to their relationship with the river?
Potentially. Again, I am not indigenous, and so I've been cautious even trying to think about what sort of disciplines are the best ways to interpret these earthworks. You can use archaeology and try and study sort of what material traces exist. But I've been influenced by contemporary indigenous thinkers that kind of talk about the earthworks as storytelling of the earth encoded in the earth itself. And so I've tried to listen to, you know, contemporary interpretations of longstanding cosmologies that talk about it. And so I have come to think that, yeah, they have this spiritual meaning. There are lots of stories about the world being created by mud being dragged up from the bottom of a watery world. Wow. And so the creation of these earthworks in some ways seems to sort of redo that creation, which might have been an act of restoration for people to kind of say, oh, the world's in crisis and we need to renew everything.
Right. Well, they certainly weren't there to hold back the river. But when white settlers came along, they, like you mentioned, start to build levees at some point. When does that first occur, and what were these levees, you know, were these levees effective?
Sure. So the first levee that was built on the Mississippi, we believe it was finished around 1720, I think. And so this is just almost immediately after New Orleans is first settled, not even as a city at that point, but just a little sort of encampment.
Right.
The French were coming in kind of with these dreams of creating massive tobacco farms. They needed a headquarters, and then they were like, well, this place flooded. We better do something to stop that, and built this little wall along what is today the French Quarter. It really didn't, you know, it started to expand in Louisiana over almost immediately, but over for the next 100 years or so, it kind of was mostly just in the region known as the Delta, kind of the swampy bottom of the river. What really changed was when the United States of America fully claimed the Mississippi River. It was the first time anyone even conceived of thinking that one power could control the whole of this watershed. And then the levees started to expand in size, expand in scope to what we have now, where basically the entire 1,000 miles of the southern Mississippi are lined in both ends, wherever there are sort of openings for rivers or bluffs. And that has allowed, I mean, in some ways you might say they're successful. It's led to, you know, a lot of wealth producing farmland. But I do think the combination of climate change and sort of the unexpected effects of river engineering are now showing that those levees are not going to do their job forever.
Right. And inherently a river, its characteristic is that it is dynamic and it does flow and it is ever changing and evolving. So it seems like there would be a few consequences of having this engineering happening along the Mississippi. Do you have examples of what may have occurred as a result of the stepping in and changing how it's flowing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the Mississippi River, even more than most rivers, is sort of an exemplar of a river that's dynamic because of this, its size, because of its alluvial nature. It's kind of in the south, it's running through land that it created itself, and therefore it's very soft and muddy land that easily kind of gives way and shifts. And the most famous effect of these levees, I think, and one of the most pressing is where I live in Louisiana. You know, the marshland is very famously disappearing, and that those marshes were created by the river kind of spreading over its levees and dropping out mud. And when you stop the river from doing that, that can no longer happen. So the town where I live, New Orleans, is under real threat now because the marshes that are disappearing also dampen the effects of hurricanes, and hurricanes are getting worse. But that is one, you know, that's one of many things that come with the levees. I mean, also in Louisiana, there is sort of this threat. The Mississippi will change course entirely, and we've been kind of holding it in place for the past 80 or so years, but it's not clear that we'll be able to keep the river where it is forever.
Talk a little more about why these marshes are disappearing. Is it the change in water flow, just general erosion going on?
Yeah. So what, I mean, typically, or the way the Delta was made was the Mississippi flowed down into Louisiana and started to fork apart into lots of different paths.
Right.
And in doing so, right, as it slows down, it can't hold its sediment and drops that out. And so it was partially this sort of forking nature of the river, and that we don't allow that anymore. We've kind of constrained it into one path.
Mm.
It's partially the fact that in natural floods, you know, the flood itself would carry some mud out and lay out this marshland. And so now essentially all of that sediment is retained inside the river channel, which reaches so far. Now the mouth of the Mississippi River is essentially almost at the edge of the continental shelf. So the sediment gets carried by the water and then just gets dumped way out in the deep ocean. And so we're not rebuilding this land. And that land kind of naturally sinks and settles because the sediment is so soft. There's kind of space between the sediment. And it needs to be replenished for the marsh to stay. And that's not happening. I would point out, too, though, that it's not just river engineering. You know, oil extraction and other human interventions are also contributing to this by sort of bringing salt water into areas that would not normally be salty and poisoning plants and then losing some of the sort of structure of that landscape.
So we're changing the complexities of these ecosystems,
right,
and also the plant life and animals that depend upon them.
The cascading effect.
And so, yes, we're looking at this cascading effect. So if you go to different areas of the Mississippi, are you still seeing any natural ecosystems, or have we so much altered it that is just not there anymore?
Oh, you definitely do see some natural ecosystems. I mean, I think this is one of the things that immediately fascinated me the first time I went to the Mississippi. I grew up in New England and kind of wound up in Mississippi through the happenstance of being 25 and looking for an adventure, and then wound up camping on the river. And I had always thought it would be this giant engineered ditch with, you know, a lot of pollution. And I got out there and it's just these beautiful, beautiful wide forests, sweeping sandbars. And so I do think it is, like, sort of upends our idea of what's natural and what's engineered. the Mississippi remains as wild as anywhere in North America, depending on how you define wild, while at the same time, it's as engineered as any waterway in the world. And so one of my aims with this book is to wake people up to the fact that there is this beautiful river here that we should pay more attention to. And I think a lot of people could fall in love with the river if they got out there to see it.
We're speaking with Boyce Upholt. He is the author of the new book, The Great River, The Making and the Unmaking of the Mississippi. Boyce, there's no Mississippi if there isn't all its rivers that feed it. The Missouri, the Ohio, the Tennessee, the Red, the Arkansas, just to name a few. Are changes in those rivers having an impact on the Mississippi, whether it's by water quantity or water quality?
Absolutely. Not just water quantity, but sediment quantity is a big thing. I mean, we put dams on so many rivers across this country, and then those dams wind up sort of being blockades for the mud that would naturally come down to Louisiana. So that is another issue to consider in what we're talking about the losses of marsh in Louisiana. Interestingly, I think that it looked like there are some records that show almost there was more mud in the river for a while because so many farms were being installed across the watershed that the soils were washing off even more and more quickly. So there is sort of this peak era in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And so there are some numbers that suggest the dams now have kind of brought things back to their historical levels. But that said, if we opened up those dams and let the water flow, that would bring more sediment down to Louisiana. That could be very helpful. And then I look beyond even just the rivers, but into the watershed. I mean, can anything you build, it can't help but be in the watershed. So every parking lot, every farm kind of causes water to run more quickly off the landscape into rivers. And so the devastating floods that we've seen in recent years, in 2009 especially, are really exacerbated by the fact that we kind of build willy-nilly without thinking about how everything is connected to these river systems.
Yeah, I remember fishing along the Little Arkansas River way up in the Colorado foothills. And first come to realization that, you know, a drop of water in that river that, you know, that flowed by my boot, my hip waders, conceivably it would end up in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, weeks or a month or so later. That's how large this tributary is.
Yes, I actually had a very similar experience. After my longest canoe trip in 2017, I wound up in Colorado for a wedding, and a friend and I went kind of backpacking up in Rocky Mountain National Park, and we were hiking home and saw sort of, I realized, you know, the first snow of the season was melting at our feet, and I was like, oh, wow, this water is going to be, you know, I'm about to fly home tomorrow, but this water is going to enter the Mississippi River 15 miles from where I live. And it was a moment of, you know, feeling at home, but realizing, like, if I consider the Mississippi River my home, how expansive that home is.
You know, we've been talking a lot about sediment, the physical components of the river. There's water quality, too, and these farms are notorious for introducing fertilizer as part of their runoff into the river, most notably nitrogen. And we know that gets downstream, gets into the Gulf, eventually makes its way to the Gulf. And creates potentially anoxic conditions, otherwise known as the dead zone, which I believe starts in, I think, around now in the Gulf. And so there's the chemical and biological impacts that go all the way into the Gulf.
Yeah, they do. And weirdly, now, because of our engineering, they go to places that they wouldn't normally go. So I mentioned a moment ago the 2019 flood, which was in many places the longest flood on record on the Mississippi River. One of the things that we do down in the South to protect New Orleans from all that flood water is kind of divert some of the water east into Lake Pontchartrain, which then flows into the Mississippi Sound. And so this is a water body that, you know, historically has never really been touched by Mississippi waters. But in 2019, so much Mississippi water got sent that way that it devastated oysters, it devastated crabs, it devastated shrimp. And that's really become a complication for our future of flood control, because locals sued overall. That was a lot of economic damage, and the Army Corps now has to consult with fisheries experts federally before they can open up that floodway. So again, it just shows the kind of complicated cascading effects of intervening in something like a river.
And also, you know, I'm an environmental engineer, so I spend a lot of time working on drinking water systems and wastewater systems. Hey, the Mississippi is used as both. You know, one town's wastewater is another town's downstream potential drinking water. So I remember, I think at some point, this is years ago, someone told me that it's not uncommon if you're down in the New Orleans area that that water that you take out to turn into drinking water may have been used and reused some 10 to 12 times before that.
Interesting. I have not heard that stat. I mean, I will say, I mean, I when I do canoe, if I'm in Mississippi, I find the water now these days, Clean Water Act has done enough that I'm going to boil it, but I swim in it a lot. We will make coffee with it. I do not do that in Louisiana where, you know, starting at Baton Rouge, there are quite a number of industrial facilities
yes.
that you kind of sit right on the riverbanks. And it does not feel like the friendliest place to be pulling water out of the river.
No.
So you have been working on this book for years now. How do you feel about what the future holds for the Mississippi River?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that the future of the Mississippi River, kind of no matter what, is a difficult future. It's both the things we've built have done a lot of damage to ecosystems and increasingly to human communities. And yet it's going to be very hard for us to unbuild what we've built because they continue, right? New Orleans, where I live, the Mississippi Delta, a region I lived in for 9 years and love, are places that couldn't exist without our flood control infrastructure. It's just going to be a difficult choice of figuring out how can we start to give more territory back to the river. It's the only real solution when it comes to both the flooding and the ecology. What does give me hope, I mean, I feel like my book is actually one of many books that are being released that are about the Mississippi River from, you know, Percival Everett's great new novel, James, to, you know, travelogues about canoeing the river. And I feel like this wave of books has shown me that I'm not alone and kind of realizing what an asset we have in the river and thinking differently about how to treat it. So it's exciting to me to see potentially there's sort of a cultural shift underway.
Are there efforts afoot to remove some of these levees where possible, maybe as acts of conservation, and return those land masses to kind of their natural floodplains?
Yeah, there definitely are. Some of the big sort of environmental nonprofits and NGOs have big programs trying to remove the levees in some cases. In other cases, you don't even necessarily need to remove the levees to help with flooding, in that if you just restore a wetland on the, quote, dry side of the levee, that can still store water. And so there are some efforts to put wetland forests back in sort of marginal farmland as carbon credit projects, which has the added bonus of sort of helping with all of this hydrological mess. Even the Army Corps, I mean, famously, but they've really been touting a project in on the Missouri River, where after those really bad floods in 2019, a community decided, hey, what we have to do is pull this levee back in our community, give the river a little bit more room. It was cheaper to pull the levee back than to kind of rebuild a levee that was so devastated by that flood. So again, there is a tide turning, but the one paper I read sort of indicated that the size of the 2019 flood, when you really look at the amount of levees that we'd have to pull back to contain a flood of that magnitude, we have a long way to go before we're really doing the job fully.
And wasn't it just 6 or 8 months ago the river was suffering under drought conditions and the water levels
yeah.
were so low that shipping traffic was blocked?
It's been a bit of a whiplash. We had about 10 years of sort of seeming like high water every year, and then 2 years of extraordinarily low water, it's been a problem for shipping. It's been a problem down in Louisiana. There's communities in Plaquemines Parish downstream of New Orleans that couldn't get water for weeks because they pull water out of the river and it had fallen below their intakes. Some of the modeling I've seen has suggested that we need to be more worried about the flooding than the low water in the years to come, given some of the factors at play. But again, it's just models. It's hard to say. So I take these past few years as one more reminder that this river is hard to predict, does a lot of crazy things, and will always pose a challenge for us.
Yeah, and whiplash is probably the operative word nowadays with respect to climate change, because now we're seeing some areas of Texas and maybe yours who are inundated by rains these last few weeks. So there's going to be a lot of dynamics associated with the water going in or not going into the river. So climate change is going to obviously have a bearing on a watershed this large.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, I mean, one of the thing, reasons why I think maybe people elsewhere in the country outside the watershed should pay attention to the Mississippi is that I think of climate change as sort of chaos, right? It's just going to mean more chaos. And the Mississippi has always been that chaos. And so that's part of what fascinated me so much about studying how indigenous people lived along this river for thousands of years. People had to find a way to live amid chaos. And I think that may offer us lessons now as we're seeing chaos on and off the watershed.
The name of the book is The Great River, The Making and the Unmaking of the Mississippi. The author is Boyce Upholt. Boyce, do you have a website?
I do. It is boyceupholt.com.
All right.
An easy one to remember.
Thank you.
It will obviously be on our website later today.
Yes.
Boyce, thank you so much. Is there a project that you are currently working on right now?
I'm sort of focused. This is my first book, so I'm trying to savor it. I'm doing a lot of traveling up and down the river to read from it and speak to people. And if people are interested in kind of seeing this river, I'll be going out in a canoe with some friends later this month. And that is a ticketed journey that others can come on, so you can find information on my website.
That's phenomenal. And the best way to get people to act is to get people to care, right? So
and experience.
Yeah, so thank you so much for your work and being on our show today.
Thanks,
we appreciate
Boyce.
It
thank you, take care.